Oh, Wayne, I don't play Farmville or Words with Friends or Mafia Wars or the other social games that you can play on Facebook or on mobile devices. But millions and millions and millions of people do, making them an important and profitable part of the gaming industry. The social games company Zynga has been generating big bucks and is responsible for something like 12% of Facebook's revenue. But while the public has embraced these games, some critics are concerned that players are being exploited. For instance, some games encourage players to pay real money for virtual items. So today on Radio Times, we want to take a look at the social gaming phenomenon, and we want to hear from the gamers in our audience. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Let me introduce our guests, both of whom join us by telephone. Ian Bogos is Director of Graduate Studies in the School of Literature, Communication, and Culture at Georgia Tech. He's also the founder of Persuasive Games and created the satirical Facebook game called Cow Clicker. And Ian Bogos, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here.
Also with us is Nikki, research scientist at the Palo Alto Research Center, has extensive research background in the psychology of virtual environments and online interactions. And Nikki, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Great to be here, Marty.
And Ian, let me begin with you, and let me begin with some really basic questions, because I want to make sure that everyone listening knows exactly what we're talking about. Ian, how would you describe a social game? What are we talking about here?
So we hear this phrase, social game, but usually what people are really referring to are the kind of games that you play on Facebook or Google Plus or these other social network services, or the extensions of them on mobile devices like the iPhone. Even though they're called social games, the social properties, the idea of playing with others, are very particular for these games. And so they emerged during the heyday of Facebook's platform in 2007, 2008, when a kind of viral spread and growth was prominent. And so these games often feature, you know, bringing other people into play, microtransactions or virtual payments for goods. They're usually free to play, but you can buy other things in the game, or you may have to purchase things to advance. So it's a kind of a loose set of properties that describe the genre, but a simple way to think about it is, you know, the kind of games you see on Facebook by companies like Zynga or Playdom or so forth.
Nick, it sounds like fun.
They do.
Are they? Do you play them?
I've actually played a lot of them. So, you know, one mechanic that they really leverage on is a progress, a points and leveling mechanic. And I am a numbers optimizer, so I get sucked into a lot of these games. And it's odd because, you know, as we'll talk about later, sometimes you can make a very pure behavioral conditioning Skinner box and people don't see it and they keep playing, and I can talk about it. But when I pick up these games, boy, you know, sometimes I will play them a lot myself.
Well, and I need to understand, when you say you're a numbers optimizer, you got to translate that for us. What do you mean?
Oh, sorry. So,
that's okay.
I love understanding the rules and the patterns and the equations underneath the game so that I can optimize, you know, whatever the underlying equation is. So in a game like Farmville, for example, I will roll out the spreadsheets, look at spreadsheets that other people have put online, and figure out, you know, if I only have, you know, a certain number of hours to play each day, what's the optimal plant for me to be planting to get the most money each day. So I'm an optimizer like that.
Ian, let me go back to you and actually pick up on Farmville, which I know is one of the very popular social games. If you don't mind just describing how that works, because I think that allows us to discuss some of the interesting features associated with social games.
Right. I mean, the game is really simple. You get a farm, a little farm, and you can plant crops and get livestock, and you have to come back later to harvest those crops. And if you don't come back at the right time, then they may wither and die, and you've lost that opportunity. You can bring in your Facebook friends to help you out. You can send them things. They can come visit you and send you stuff. And you can kind of slowly amass, you know, a larger and larger plot of land and a more complex farm, and you have to manage it and advance in the game in that fashion. So it sounds, you know, kind of pleasurable, like gardening.
Yeah, and what's the problem with that?
Well, you know, on the one hand, there's no problem with it, and this is exactly the kind of game or the kind of experience that we do all the time. Just like you might go out and garden in your yard, and you have to, you know, reap your crops at the right time. you might enjoy kind of faux gardening inside of Farmville. So the kind of farm theme, or there are other games that are like, you know, like a cafe or a city, that sort of experience is less important to me, and it's less concerning to me than the structure of the games themselves, the common features of the games that we don't see when we're focusing on making a farm or building a restaurant. And those are the kind of assumptions or structures underlying the experience, and the way that it kind of encourages us to come back, the way it creates compulsions to come back and it kind of infects the life we have away from it. Now I'm worried about my farm. Or the way that it encourages me to turn my friends that I'm playing with into these kind of Taylorist resources that now I'm thinking of as kind of farmhands to be put to use for me during the day, rather than as well-rounded individuals with particular talents and properties that I might want to interact with socially. So you know, those are the things you don't necessarily see on the surface, and the patterns that emerge over the course of these games are also replicated, you know, in other parts of online culture itself. Facebook has this kind of feeling in and of itself, even before you play the game.
That you need to stay involved. You need to keep coming back.
Right. There's something always going on.
Right.
You know, what
and you don't want to miss it.
You don't want to miss it.
Well, Nick, let me just pick up on that. I mean, we're talking about something that is extraordinarily popular. And as you both have described it, you know, as I said, it sounds like a lot of fun. Why do you think millions and millions and millions of people are playing these social games?
Well, you know, it's a couple of things. So let me answer it like a broader question first. I've been studying online games, you know, from EverQuest to World of Warcraft for over 10 years. You know, one of the things that always has struck me a lot over the years is the intersection of work and play.
Mm-hmm.
So in games like World of Warcraft, when you talk to people who lead guilds, which are these organizations of, you know, from 30 to 200 people, one of the themes that keeps coming up from guild leaders is they'll say, it feels like a second job, and it became a second job, you know, slowly over time. It kind of crept up on them. You know, first they thought it was fun, but then they have to manage the schedules and the happiness of, you know, between, you know, 15 to 200 people in their guild. And so I think we're seeing this trend spilling out. So now we're looking at Facebook games, and of course what starts out as being a fun virtual farm can end up being hours of work each day if you get into that cycle. You know, so I think what's fascinating is really looking at, you know, well, what are the mechanisms here, and, you know, clearly could they be used for good now that we see that they're being used for these, I don't want to say trivial, but, you know, can they be channeled and harnessed for more meaningful activities? I think for me as a psychologist, that's what I'm interested in.
Well, and I don't want to be too psychological here, but it sounds like you're almost describing a compulsion. I mean, that you feel, and I don't want to use the word addiction, but you feel this tug, this pull back to something that's requires your attention.
You know, and it's definitely true in the literature of people who've been looking at, you know, problematic usage, whether it's just the internet or the MMOs, the massively multiplayer online role-playing games like World of Warcraft or Facebook games. We've definitely seen clear signs of problematic usage among certain players. You know, the typical red flags tend to be psychological stressors. So people who are depressed, have low self-esteem, have social anxiety, tend to be more vulnerable to be caught up to the mechanics of these virtual worlds. You know, as one example, in World of Warcraft, oftentimes, you know, when you log on the game, you're playing a particular combat role, and someone will say, hey, you know, we need a healer, or we need a tank, a warrior. And it's this structured way in which the social dynamics create validation and need, right? So for people who don't feel that they're needed or valued or trusted in the physical world, that could be incredibly seductive, you know. But again, it's not that everyone who goes through these games will
sure.
be hooked.
Sure.
But, you know, yeah.
And, well, Marty,
yeah, go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say one of the additional features of this return, this kind of compulsion to return, is that in these social games, it's situated in a particular kind of business practice that's not unique to these games, but it's really been amplified by them, and that's one in which the players can play for free, And they can also purchase things, goods or advancement, but only something like 2 to 3% of the players, there are tens and sometimes hundreds of millions of players, are actually contributing in that way. So, you know, just like a company like Google or Facebook is kind of taking all of our information, giving us services for free, but then taking our information and using that as their business, selling our information for advertising purposes and so forth. So companies like Zynga are taking our connectivity, right, and using that as a way of marketing their games to others and of kind of spreading the flow and advancement of their games in order to produce more of these customers that will fill in that 2 to 3% that comprise their revenue. So it's not unique to Facebook games or unique to Zynga or something, but it's part of a bigger trend in which we kind of work for free as our leisure.
Well, and just picking up on that, Ian, I mean, are you talking about companies literally spying on people, or they're creating profiles and then figuring, well, then this person, if he or she enjoys this game, they might like this game?
But yeah, I mean, in the case of companies like Google, there's certainly been a lot of contemporary critique about exactly how much information is being shared and where it's being used. And some of those concerns do exist with Facebook games, too, because these games have access to your profile information. You give them access, but you don't always know exactly what that means. But more than that, in the case of a game like Farmville, the game is not so much exploiting your information as it is access to the people that you know. It's like a virus, right, that tries to spread and requires you to spread the game in order to advance in it. You've got to involve your friends. You've got to send these gifts. You've got to do things like that. And it looks harmless on the surface, and in some ways it is totally harmless. But it's important, I think, to understand the structure of the games, how they work, what they're doing, and part of what they're doing is to turn their customers into a kind of worker bees for the hive.
The idea that because you're playing these games, you're interested in these games, and you have friends, then they can use all that for their own profit and personal benefit, in a sense?
What's most important to a company like Zynga is growing their audience. If you're only getting 2 or 3% of your players to make purchases, then you need a larger and larger audience. And there's some evidence that these games are kind of cannibalizing one another. Like, you might play Farmville for a while, but you're not going to play Farmville and Castleville. You're going to choose one. So, you know, bringing more people in is very important. And it used to be easier on Facebook, and now it's become harder. And so the incentive structures are put forward in a way that this recruitment pattern really becomes a major part of the game. And, you know, you can look at that as a sort of, you know, exploitative, I'm working for free kind of situation. Or on the flip side, and this is what some people say, you know, this is a way of kind of exploring the weird relationships that we have with people. Like, one of the ways in which we involve ourselves with others is through a kind of friendly exploitation. Like, you want to get something out of your friend, and
Absolutely.
You get something back in exchange.
Absolutely. Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about social gaming with Ian Bogost and Nick Yee. And we want to hear from the gamers in our audience. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts supports WHYY and presents two summer pre-college programs for talented and motivated young people intent on a fine arts education. The Summer Academy for High School Students is a four-week college-level art-making experience on the PAFA campus, July 9th through August 3rd. PAFA Italy is a two-week summer abroad program designed to challenge young artists to hone their drawing and painting skills amidst the vibrant cultural landscape of Tuscany, Italy, July 16th through 31st. Details at pafa.edu/highschool.
This is WHYY's President Bill Morazzo with a big thank you. Thank you to the more than 8,000 of you who made the choice to support our winter membership campaign. Your generosity not only produced $800,000 that can now be used to deepen your public media experience, but stands as a ringing endorsement to this unique brand of trusted news and information. If you haven't had the chance to express your membership support, I invite you to do so by visiting whyy.org. Thank you.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY. Fox Chase has posted 5-year survival rates for major cancers on its website, Survival rates at Fox Chase are compared to those at community hospitals across the nation. This is but one measure of quality to help you make decisions about cancer care. At Fox Chase, compassionate care is much more than a number. It's part of their mission to prevail over cancer. More at foxchase.org. Fox Chase Cancer Center. Hearts plus minds.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, talking about social games that are played on Facebook or Google on mobile phones. Hugely popular, hugely profitable for the companies who make them. And our guests are Nick Yee, research scientist at the Palo Alto Research Center, and has done extensive research on the psychology of virtual environments and online interactions. Also with us is Ian Bogost, director of graduate studies in the School of Literature, Communication, and Culture at Georgia Tech. He also is a founder of Persuasive Games, and he did create this satirical game, which I do want to talk about, called Cow Clicker. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Nick, you had mentioned that for perhaps folks that are a little shyer or more awkward in the analog world, this can be a very attractive world to them. But it seems to me that that might be a good thing. I mean, that's a place where you don't have to worry about your social awkwardness because you're on the internet.
Yeah, and you know, we've seen both the good and the bad, and I think that's one of the reasons why these environments are so fascinating. So, in some of the online role playing games, we've seen a lot of anecdotes of people saying, you know, that they're shy in real life, they've never taken on a leadership role in real life, but they were accidentally put into a leadership role in a guild. And suddenly they realize, hey, it's not that hard managing other people, and they're able to transfer it back out in the physical world. Of course, we've heard stories the other way that mm-hmm. people get sucked into this vicious cycle, and it actually damages their work and their family relationships. So, you know, one of the themes that have come out from research in this area is really the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. Mm-hmm. You know, for example, in the realm of social anxiety and social support, people who have poor social support in their physical social network, who have social anxiety, who have very few friends, who prefer to interact online, they tend to get into a negative vicious cycle where they only have friends online and they neglect their real world, their physical friendships. Whereas people who, you know, play with their, you know, romantic partners, for example, there was a study that came out from Brigham Young University yesterday showing that, you know, 76% of gamers who play an online role-playing game together reported positive effects in terms of their relationships. You know, so playing together with family and friends, you know, can be healthy. So there really is both the good and the bad.
Ian, let me go back to you and ask you about Cow Clicker. I know you've been asked this many, many times. What was the inspiration for the creation of Cow Clicker?
Right. So, you know, back in 2010 or so, almost 2 years ago, when this kind of game first became popular within the games industry, there was a lot of angst and anxiety and concern and sort of unfamiliarity and uncertainty. What does this mean, and do we like these things, and are they really games? And this came to a head at a big industry conference when an award was given from Farmville. And as I was sitting in the audience listening to the kind of boos and the hisses, this idea of a cow clicker, sort of a summary of the simplicity of these games, it's just like clicking on a cow, and that's all you do,
right,
sort of popped into my head. And and then a few months later, I foolishly or not, went ahead and just made the game in which all you do is click on a cow, that was meant to be a kind of, you know, send-up, a satire, a commentary on Farmville and games of its ilk. And in Cow Clicker, you got a cow, and it was cute, and you wanted to click on it, and you'd click on it, and it would moo, and then 6 hours later, you could click on it again, or you could pay money to for the privilege to click more
Mooney,
frequently.
Mooney, as you call
yeah.
it. Mooney.
Right. There were all sorts of cow puns all
right.
throughout the thing, and
right.
you know, you could buy virtual cows that look like pirates or like Lovecraft monsters. It got really out of control, and I mean, one of the things that I've noted about the game as a creator is that kind of compulsion effect is just as powerful for the designer as it is for the player. I became obsessed with the game in the same way that I was critiquing players becoming obsessed with these games. It's just so amazing how easy, how simple something can be to still be compelling.
And do you think that the players got the satire, or it didn't matter?
Early on, most of the players
understood it as satire, played it ironically. Oh, look at me clicking on a cow. And then they could post that they clicked on a cow to their Facebook profile as a kind of, you know, commentary to their friends who were playing Farmville, like giving them the finger. Oh, look at you posting all this stuff on my wall. Well, here you go. Here's a cow. And then over time, that kind of playership declined, and people started playing just because they liked clicking on cows. And you know, there are players who've clicked on cows hundreds of thousands of times in the game, and who still click. It's very complicated, and eventually I raptured all the cows, and they were gone, and people are still clicking on the space where the cow used to be. There's not even a cow there.
Oh, my goodness gracious.
And they're still clicking on it.
Oh, the rapture, they just got sucked up into heaven, and that was the end
of
it?
Yeah, I had to end it. I couldn't take it anymore, and, you know, it felt like it had run its course, and I wanted to leave it running to see what would happen. Mm. So now all you have are the pastures. But yet still, there's something about the memory of the cow and clicking where it used to be.
Well, Nick, let me go back to you, because this all seems very Skinnerian, very Pavlovian.
It is, and I think what's scary, and Ian didn't mention this, is you cannot click continuously on the cow. You can only click on the cow once every 5 hours. So you have to come back and click on the cow. And now, of course, the absurdity of it is that the cow's not even there. Mm-hmm. So people are coming and clicking on this empty space every 5 hours. There's something scary about this, right? In the sense that, you know, we kind of knew that this would happen from a Skinnerian psychology standpoint. But I think Ian's initial assumption, and I think I would have agreed with him, you know, if we had chatted, you know, in terms of psychology, that when you strip it that bare, at some point it breaks down, right? Because people would see through it, they would realize the absurdity of it, that they're really, you know, that, you know, sure, there may have been some value in clicking on vegetables and seeing them grow and harvesting them, but here is a static image of a cow, you know, and at some point, you know, that psychology must break down, but it didn't, and I think that was what was so fascinating about it.
Yeah, did you want to add something, Ian?
Oh, I was just going to say, you know, one of the things I've written about in relation to this phenomenon of cow clicker is just how resilient people are, how amazing the human spirit is, that it will find value and meaning in just about anything. Mm-hmm. And I have to acknowledge that, even at the same time as I wonder if these are the kinds of experiences that I, as a designer of experiences, would want to put into the world for people to find value and meaning in. But there's something amazing about how even the most seemingly uninteresting, simplistic, ridiculous, offensive kind of game could produce, you know, real import for people. They're not kidding. They really like clicking on the cow.
Well, I mean, but even in the so-called analog world, I'm thinking of, you know, gambling. I mean, where people, you know, the odds are against you, but somehow you feel like you're lucky, and
sure,
they keep you at the table, and they take away the clocks, and they, you know, give you a substitute money, and you feel rich.
They do that, but then at the same time, when you're at the table, you've got a complex game like poker or blackjack that is sophisticated and that takes expertise and that involves kind of human tells and signals. It's not just clicking on a cow.
Right.
So you would expect there to be a significant difference. But in fact, there's seems to be a kind of willingness that we have to take what we're given and to kind of make the best of it. And when what we're given or what we give to the world is sort of whatever the market responds to, and we don't question it so long as it's making money, then there may be a time when we want to step back and say, okay, what's really going on here? What kind of future are we building for ourselves? And that's what I hope Cow Clicker has done in part, is help people ask that question.
Nick, anything you want to add? And then I do want to get to our callers.
Well, I think it's kind of like sugar for both the good and the bad. But what I'm curious looking ahead is, after a certain while, you know, you can give a kid, you know, sweeter and sweeter fruit juice, but after a certain point, that's just not possible anymore. It becomes saturated with sugar. Mm-hmm. And, you know, no Facebook game has really been quite as successful as the first Farmville, you know, because when Farmville came around, it was really fresh, it was kind of novel, it was interesting, but everyone's using that same formula now. And what I'm curious about is, at some time, is there saturation and fatigue, and do people just get bored with the whole genre? And I think that's what will be really interesting looking ahead.
Well, don't you think that all this stuff grew out of video games? I mean, that this is sort of the evolution of the kind of games that you can play through the internet or on your television?
But, I, you know, what I wonder is whether once people realize the simplicity of it and once they've got burned through, you know, this clicking, you know, do they actually grow tired of it and reject it? Mm-hmm. I think that's what, you know, that's what, and whether they'll fall back on more meaty, more complex games, you know, once they realize there really wasn't that much underneath the sugar.
Well, let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Nick Yee, research scientist at the Palo Alto Research Center, and he's done extensive research on the psychology of virtual environments, online interactions. Ian Bogos, also with us, director of graduate studies in the School of Literature, Communication, and Culture at Georgia Tech, also the founder of Persuasive Games, and he was telling us about Cow Clicker, a game that he created for Facebook, a satirical game. And we are taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get, it looks like a Dr. Ferguson to join us from Princeton. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Oh, hello.
Hi.
I would first like to say hi to Nick, who is on my editorial board at my publication, Games for Health Journal. Nick, very good to hear you on the air.
Great to talk to you, too.
Yeah, go ahead.
I am the editor of a new publication called Games for Health Journal, Research Applications and Research Development and Clinical Applications. And as Nick well knows, there are while there are many applications in social games for entertainment and so on, games have also been developing kind of quietly in the background as an important tool for the treatment and prevention of disease. Everything from cystic fibrosis and childhood obesity to post-traumatic stress disorder in returning veterans. And I would first of all like to,
well, you
to
know
thank
what?
All
let me just take your point only because we have a lot of people, and,
sure.
And you actually raise a very interesting point, something we haven't talked about. I'll give Nick Yee a chance to respond. The idea of using these games for health purposes. Does that make sense to you, Nick?
Yeah, it does. And I think, you know, again, as I mentioned earlier, you know, what we're learning about through these experiments in social games and online games in general are the underlying mechanisms that motivate and persuade people and change their attitudes and behaviors. And those can be used for both, you know, the good and the bad and the trivial. And I think what's really important, you know, in terms for social scientists is really figuring out how can we leverage these mechanisms for positive behavior change, whether that's in healthcare, for the environment, and so forth. So just as two quick examples, you know, I was at the lab at Stanford run by Jeremy Bailenson. You know, we've done studies such as showing when we create a virtual doppelganger of you, a virtual avatar that looks exactly like you, and you watch your doppelganger run on a treadmill, you're actually more likely to exercise in the next 24 hours. That study was done by Jesse Fox. In another study, we found that, you know, if we make you cut down a virtual tree, you become sensitized to paper waste. And that was also a study at the Stanford lab. So, you know, so again, we're interested in understanding the mechanisms in virtual worlds that can be leveraged for positive behaviors and attitudes.
Well, that's fascinating. Let me get Catherine from Bryn Mawr to join us. And Catherine, go ahead. You are on Radio Times.
I wanted to speak as somebody who drank the sugar water and couldn't stand it. And I only do social games that are word-based. So I play versions of Scrabble, like Words with Friends and Lexulus. And I do so for a long period of time, every day, little bits during the day. And I have developed friendships all over the world, real friendships. I've never met the people, but one woman in London has dementia. I play or give her suggestions on a game. I have friends in almost all the time zones, and I consider these people very good friends. I've sent wedding gifts to them. I've done, you know, even though they're people that are just virtual friends, they are real to me.
Well, I appreciate your call.
To me, it's a very important and vital part of my day. It keeps my brain going, and I enjoy it tremendously.
Well, we can hear the yeah. passion in your call. Ian, do you want to weigh in
yeah,
on that?
Yeah, I think there are two important things about Catherine's point. One is that these games, many kinds of games, like puzzles and the crossword and the Sudoku, they give us a sense of ritual. Written about this in relation to newspaper games, you know, that it's not so much
the language or that you're learning words or something when you do the crossword, but you have this ritual activity. It warms your brain up. It gives you a sense of completeness that there is something you can solve in the world, that it just kind of gives you something to do that you do every day with your coffee. And games can serve that purpose on Facebook or on mobile phones or in lots of different platforms. There's lots more to say about that. But the other point is that the friendships, the idea of connecting with people is very much real. You know, the kinds of relationships that are built with Geese Games, I've seen it with Cow Clicker even. People have said the same thing. You know, I meet these people and I interact with them, and they made these cow coloring pages of each other, all sorts of crazy stuff. Those things are real. They do happen. And the question in my mind is not so much are these games good or bad, or does the good outweigh the bad, but rather what is their structure and how are they changing the way that we live in the world? And if we kind of step back and try to look at them that way, it's going to be complicated. We're not going to be able to draw simple conclusions.
Nick, you want to weigh in on that as a psychologist?
So, you know, it is all about having a healthy palette of, you know, work and social relationships. It's clearly not a black box where you put someone in, they'll come out better or worse. But that it's possible, you know, to have, you know, online friendships as part of a broader palette of social relationships.
Well, you know, it's funny, as you both are talking, I was thinking about an interview I did years ago about the invention of the telephone. And all the worry that, you know, the telephone was going to ruin family life, it was going to hurt communication. Perhaps legitimate worries at the time, but it seems that new technology often gets put in this particular kind of box, that it's going to ruin the way that we interact with each other. And to me, it's just another sort of extension, another way that we can communicate with the world. Nick?
You know, I would agree with you. You know, when the telephone first came around, there was this concern that it gave women too much power, because women could make calls from the home, and oh my God, that would bring about, you know, bring about the end of the world. You know, that hasn't happened. And, you know, I think it's the same thing in the virtual world. You know, we're still in this phase where we're trying to figure out what the unique affordances and levers, and there are, you know, for example, this notion of virtual doppelgangers is a novel affordance of these virtual worlds, and I still think we're in that formative phase of trying to understand, you know, what those levers are. So there's still so much more to learn, and there's so much more potential there.
And Ian, about a minute before our second break here, but I know that there are concerns that that marketers, businesses are making so much money off of people's fascination with these social games.
Well, people make money in the world in lots of ways.
Sure.
I mean, it's funny. We tend to both worry and celebrate making money. And there's some sort of, you know, switch that flips when suddenly what used to be virtuous, making money, is something we very much value in our culture, and we celebrate capitalism, and successful businessmen are considered heroes in many cases. And then there's some point at which it becomes strange and squirrely. And certainly the connection of these games, the way that they resemble gambling systems or addiction systems, that may be part of what gives folks that sense. I think another part of it is just that we don't fully understand, culturally speaking, what it is that's being sold or bought yet. When you buy the right to click on your cow 5 hours earlier than you would otherwise be allowed to, that's not the kind of good or service that we're as familiar with as, you know, buying a toaster or getting your dry cleaning done. And we're kind of struggling through that question of what it means to have the real world and the virtual world coincide more than they once did.
Ian, hold on to that thought, only because we're up on a break here. We'll get right back to our conversation talking about social gaming with Ian Bogost and Nick Yee, and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hello, this is Margaret Kuo. To celebrate the Cherry Blossom Festival with the Japan American Society, Dr. Hamada from Villanova and I will present a tutorial launching in my Wayne restaurant on Sunday, February 26th. Margaret Kuo's restaurants support WHYY.
Penn's College of Liberal and Professional Studies supports WHYY. Penn's Master of Liberal Arts program allows students to combine graduate-level classes into a single master's degree built around what matters to them. Their interdisciplinary curriculum includes seminars that offer new perspectives on subjects that interest the student. Instructors and peers in creative writing workshops share experiences as writers that can help students hone their craft. Details on how to pursue your passion for writing at Penn online by searching Penn MLA.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Writer James Fallows takes stock of President Obama in this election year and asks, is he chess master or pawn? Also, you've heard of flash mobs. Now some communities are embracing cash mobs, sending crowds with cash to small businesses. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
10,000 Villages in Ephrata supports WHYY, now hosting their annual rug event, featuring the Fairtrade Bunyad Rug Collection of over 1,500 hand-knotted rugs. Online at rugs.10,000villages.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're talking about the social gaming phenomenon with Nick Yee, research scientist at the Palo Alto Research Center, and also with Ian Bogost, director of graduate studies in the School of Literature, Communication, and Culture at Georgia Tech, and just one open line at 1-888-477-9499. Ian, picking up on what you were saying right before the break, and I just want to make sure our listeners understand this use of, I guess, of money to buy virtual products, which is part of this whole gaming phenomenon. Help everyone understand how that works.
Sure. So, you know, you play one of these games. They're usually free. You can download it on your mobile phone, or you can load it up in your Facebook. And you can play up to a certain point. You can, you know, maybe advance. And then you reach a point when maybe you need a particular resource, or you want access to a kind of building that you can't get without purchasing it, or a special weapon or something like that. Or alternately, maybe you want to customize your experience in CowClicker. You want a prettier cow that, you know, matches your personality or something. And you can pay money in order to get those things, and that money is sometimes earned in the game. Like, it's, you know, it's not real money, but it's money that you've accumulated through play. And in other cases, it's script that you exchanged for real money on Facebook. The way that works is with a system called Facebook credits. So once you have spent money on these credits, then you can spend them in game on, you know, a new outfit or a new tractor or something. And that's how it works. And this has been around for some time. It's just that it's only recently caught on with these Facebook games and with mobile games as a kind of mass market trend.
And Nick, does it worry you that people are using real money to buy things that don't really exist?
Well, no. I mean, we're used to buying, you know, virtual goods, whether it's stocks or, you know, digital music. You know, we're used to trading, you know, physical currency for virtual goods. You know, I think what's fascinating in online games is that what some of us in the Western world play for fun is actually outsourced as work in other countries. So in games where there's a virtual gold in the game, you can go on eBay and buy that gold, you know, with U.S. dollars, but that gold is being farmed by people who, quote-unquote, play the game, but their only job is to accumulate virtual currency to sell. So there's a fascinating economy behind all this.
Go ahead, Ian, then we'll get some more comments
in. I'm just going to add a simple point, yeah, which is there's nothing really new about virtual goods, or about the idea of buying something that doesn't really exist. When you buy a brand name pair of jeans instead of the cheapest one you can find, then you're buying something that kind of doesn't exist. You're buying the status associated with the brand. And we've done that for decades and decades. There's nothing terribly new about it. It's just that now we're getting these digital files or these sort of representations on the screen rather than a real physical product.
But I can see us sort of, you know, moving into this digital world, you know, more and more. And I'm not complaining, but, you know, one senses that's the direction that we're going in. Ian?
Sure. I mean, you know, we're now, you know, listening to music and watching movies and television and buying and reading books on our computers or on our tablets or on our phones. Mm-hmm. And less of that world that used to be physical is becoming digital. But it's not that it's disappearing. It's that it's taking a new form. And the way that new form operates and interacts with the rest of our lives, we're still struggling to figure out.
Let me see what Beverly from Rose Valley has to say. Beverly, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. This is my first time calling, so I'm nervous.
Good. No, you're doing fine, Beverly. Go ahead.
Okay, thanks. I'm here to stick up for Farmville. 3 years ago, I had a family tragedy, and I started playing, and it was an easier way to connect with the world, you know, via Facebook. And then I learned about Farmville, and I started playing Farmville, and friends were playing it. I have complete control over my farm in Farmville. Mm-hmm. And I have a gravesite where I can give somebody flowers every day. And I grew up in the desert, so I have a little desert area. And, you know, I've got a Chinese garden, and then sometimes I have an English, we lived in England for 5 years, so I have an English maize. And I don't tell anybody, but I guess some people are going to know now that I play Farmville. And but it just gives me some serenity, and it gives me some feeling that I have control over this little part of my world.
Well, that's fascinating, Beverly, and I want to give our guests a chance to weigh in on that. And Nikki, let me start with you.
I think Kim's therapy is definitely something that, you know, we're interested in it as well, and I'm glad that point was brought up.
Yeah.
You know, so in the anecdotes I hear from players, this point that the ritual sides of play can be therapeutic or positive or calming and relaxing, it definitely comes up. And, you know, in fact, I've spoken to some therapists who talk about how, you know, instead of reacting against, you know, online gaming play, that could be integrated, you know, as a form of therapy, that you can, you know, when you elicit what people do via their characters, they're more open about what their characters do rather than what they like and what they do. You know, so I think it's definitely an important point that games can be therapeutic.
And also, Ian, it shows, I mean, in a sense, Beverly's creativity. She was dealing with some kind of loss or crisis in her life and figured out how to help herself.
Sure, and that speaks to that, you know, that kind of idea of resilience that I was mentioning earlier, and also underscores the idea of control or being in control of something in a world out of control. And
yeah.
And this is the same kind of ritual that we get from from the crossword. I've written about this too in my last book on relaxation, games as sort of calming effects that aren't necessarily meant to produce much more than a kind of a sense of serenity. And these things are certainly present in games, whether they're on Facebook or off Facebook. So I think, and this is just a really hard exercise to play with ourselves, but we're so tempted to look at Farmville and think what we're interested in criticizing or celebrating is Farmville or is Zynga, and rather, what we want to do is kind of look underneath Farmville and say, what is the engine that makes it work? What are these kind of machines that are driving our activities, and how do they operate, and how do they interact with our lives? Because they're going to produce all sorts of effects, some of which we celebrate, some of which we might be concerned about, right, many of which we don't even see. So trying to see that as it's happening, as it's playing out, it's difficult, and this is the challenge with studying and intervening in media, whether as a scholar or as an artist.
Well, and Nick, I mean, we're at the sort of beginnings of the social gaming phenomenon, so I guess there is a lot of research to do to try to figure out what's at play here, what's at work here.
Absolutely. You know, and again, you know, again, both the good and the bad, and, you know, the therapy and that fine edge between people who are able to leverage this therapy and people for whom it becomes a vicious cycle. There's so many variables in there that we're still trying to understand.
And let's get back to our callers at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I'm not sure what that loud hum is, but let me get Carol from Bala Cynwyd to join our conversation. And Carol, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
I've got a very sweet story. My nephew was a shy, very sweet but shy college student in Arizona, and he was playing a game called RuneScape, some sort of a medieval game.
Mm-hmm.
And in addition to RuneScape, they have something called Rune Village, which is a chat room where the players, they use their avatar names, but they talk about actual things in their lives, I think. And he had been chatting with this person who had a male avatar for years, and then finally she confessed to him that she was actually a girl.
Hmm.
And they started emailing each other, and then they actually met. She was in Toronto, and he graduated. He went to Toronto and worked for a couple years. They just got married this summer.
Wow.
They're very happy. They never would have met otherwise.
Oh, that's fascinating. And he met her first as an avatar.
As a male avatar. Her brother and she had started playing at the same time. This is another issue.
Yeah.
And she was a female avatar, and she wasn't getting much action in the game. and her brother lost interest, and she took over his male avatar.
Oh, I love
and
this.
Had more success in the game.
Oh, my goodness, Carol. I love this call. Let me give both of our guests, Nick, I'll start with you, your response.
So I actually did a small study of about 120 couples who are physically dating who first met online, and the most fascinating question was, if the two of you had met face-to-face first, do you think the relationship would have happened still? And 60% of the respondents said no. If we had met face-to-face first, the relationship wouldn't have happened because we would have written each other off for superficial reasons. You know, she's too tall, he's too blue-collar, I don't like his job, he lives too far. But it was because they kind of learned about each other from the inside out. You know, with this working relationship, they saw how each other responded under stress with other people when things didn't go their way. And then they figure out, you know, now tell me more about who you are in the physical world, that they were able to create these quote-unquote impossible relationships, right? Relationships that they didn't think would happen in the physical world. So there's definitely something, there's something fascinating here.
Carol mentioned the fact that this was, I guess, her nephew was masquerading as a male avatar because as a female wasn't getting the kind of response she wanted. Does that surprise you, Ian?
Oh, no, this is very common. You know, certainly there are ups and downs to online interactions, but video games don't necessarily have the best reputation for being friendly environments to women in these online situations in particular. But I think what the fundamental story tells us is that games are also places we go. There are these virtual places we go. And so instead of going to the coffee shop or the bar or the club, now we also go into these virtual spaces. And a game like RuneScape is, you know, quite a bit different than a game like Farmville. One of the complaints that some people issue against these social games is that even though they're called social games, they seem to discourage that kind of direct interaction within the game rather than opening it up and kind of producing an environment in which people's own individual talents can thrive. And there are many, many stories about this in the context of massively multiplayer games.
And Nick, are we seeing social gaming, in a sense, replacing TV watching? Are we at that point yet? Do we know?
It's hard. Well, TV watching has definitely been going down. You know, but again, we're still, you know, seeing. I think there's both a space there for passive media consumption as well as for active. And I know I have friends who come home and they're just too tired to be on the computer and too tired to be working with other people, and they just want a passive experience. So I think there'll always be a time for that spectrum of passive versus active media consumption.
What do you think, Ian?
Certainly we hear these kind of trend reports about the number of hours people are spending on Facebook versus spending on television, and there are some who would like to celebrate the end of mass media and broadcast media and the rise of computer media, internet-based media. But television is still so incredibly powerful and reaches so many people all at once that it's hard to underestimate exactly how big it is. We're still living in a television world, I think.
Let me get, looks like Jude from Northern Liberties to join our conversation. And Jude, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Yes, hi, Marty.
Hello.
Thank you very much. I love your show. I listen to it whenever I can. And I'm also a little nervous because this is my first time calling in. But
wow.
My question is, since we are still discovering so much about the brain and how the brain works, and one of the things that we have discovered is that things like media and particularly social media can be addictive, I was just wondering if Nick and Ian could comment on that in any way? Have they seen any of this in their research? I mean, I think that the possibilities of gaming in healthcare and in treatment of pain and things like PTSD, I think that those are fascinating. But I'm just wondering if they could comment at all on this this sort of phenomenon of media addiction that we have seen.
Jude, thanks for calling into Radio Times. We talked about compulsion, but let me give Ian a chance for you to take a crack at that. What do you think?
Sure. So this is not my area of research, and I'm not a cognitive scientist either, but I think there is real addiction to lots of things, among them games. And, you know, one definition of addiction is not being able to stop a pattern of behavior when you want to stop. And certainly we can, if we use a general definition like that, we can say it about anything. I think, though, the tendency we have to ask these kind of, you know, brain science depth questions about phenomena in the world are sometimes excuses not to follow our gut and to say, I have a feeling about the way I want to live in the world. And we can do that. We can move forward sometimes without an fMRI scan.
What do you think, Nick?
I think as we mentioned earlier, it's really those red flags that make certain people more vulnerable. There are certainly people who develop problematic usage. I think we just need to be really careful about, you know, whether we're blaming the technology or understanding the problem holistically. So, for example, for people who are depressed or have low self-esteem, when you take away the game, it doesn't actually solve their problem. And so I think, you know, for a lot of therapists are recognizing now that someone who presents with an online gaming problem, there's almost always an underlying or an adjoining psychological stressor that's occurring. And what's really, really important is to identify that underlying stressor.
Well, and we're almost out of time here, but Nick, I have to confess that, you know, I obsessively check my email. I do.
Right,
and it's just, you know, I want to see if anyone's trying to get in touch with me, I guess. So, and sometimes even driving in the car and I know my phone is there, I feel this impulse to check my email. I don't, but I feel that impulse. Nick?
I'm not sure I have anything directly to that more, you know, than I have about
my true confessions
email. Ian, do you have anything?
I think this is exactly right. You know, right. Twitter, Facebook, email, the mobile phone. We are surrounding ourselves with these devices and these software experiences that ask us to come back.
Yes.
And it's not just Facebook games. Maybe they are kind of the harbinger, the early signal of a kind of cultural shift that we've been taking part in for many years now, but haven't quite noticed.
Well, it's been a great pleasure. My thanks to both of you. Ian Bogos, thank you for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thanks so much.
And Nikki, thank you very much as well.
Thanks, Marty.
And thank you for those callers. You can also go to whyy.org/Radio Times and find out much more about this program. Radio Times intern Emily Bryant produced this show. Fred Snyder, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. And this program is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty Leswing, Dennis Devine, Debbie Bilder, and with help from Jonathan Best. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us. And coming up.